Hey everyone, it's your American F1 Journal here. We had a chance to catch up with none other than NASCAR icon Bill Lester as part of our Drivers of Color series here on The Rundown. The Berkeley graduate made his NASCAR debut in 1999, becoming the first African American to run in the Busch Series. Lester also participated in a number of Nextel Cup Series from 2008 to 2010. The 15-year Hewlett-Packard software engineer also spoke with us about a multitude of topics, including diversity and inclusion in motorsport. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Bill Lester. So I guess first off, are you staying safe? How are things going over there where you are? And how have you been handling things during this time, during the pandemic and the lockdown?
Everybody's staying safe here. We are like, you know, boarding the house like that song goes. even 4th of July, I mean, you couldn't go anywhere, even though a lot of people went places, which I don't understand, but we kind of stayed close to home. And the kids, I got two teenage sons, 17 and 14. And so, even though they weren't real fireworks, we had some sparklers and we goofed around throwing sparklers in the air and stuff like that. And just social distanced and, you know, just tried to stay safe. I have a pretty good friend who is coming out of coronavirus and COVID-19, and it's just real. It just made it really real for me, and I just don't want anybody to be affected. My mother-in-law is actually staying with us here in Georgia. She's from California. She's from Northern California in Daly City. Mm-hmm. And before the lockdown really started taking place, we flew her back out here so she would be with us because she's on her own, and we knew that if things got sketchy like they'd become, that she wouldn't have really any infrastructure. So we got, you know, my family and then my mother-in-law. So yeah. The house is big enough.
Exactly. You really have to watch out, you know, because our elderly are very important in this time that we watch after them. You know, my mom's locked down right now. She's not going anywhere. So I have to make sure she's safe.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we could not bring anything in that might, you know, affect their immune system and, you know, their ability to respond. So we're being extremely careful. We haven't been out to dinner, you know, and I don't know how long. I don't even know what that's like anymore. You know, I mean, everything is either, you know, purchased and bought here with regard to food that we might order in, or we're just cooking, you know, but haven't been to a movie theater and I don't know how long. And, you know, I feel the worst for my sons because this is a period of time where they should be out there hanging out with their friends, interacting with them and all that kind of thing. And they're not doing that, you know? And so it's sad. And we don't even know what the situation is going to be like once the fall comes, because, you know, we don't know if it's going to be a continuation of digital learning, or if indeed they'll be able to go back to school for some period of time. They're talking now about maybe 1 week at school and then 2 weeks at home learning, back to school for another week. I mean, it's just all convoluted. So nobody knows what's going to happen. So it's kind of, you know, apprehensive times.
It is. It's some very interesting times that we're in right now. And I think going forward, it's going to definitely, I think it's changing the landscape of the world and, you know, how we do things and interact with each other, you know, and especially here in the United States. I mean, we're so social, you know, we're so used to having our, you know, our habits. We're creatures of habit at times. And, you know, now we have to change those habits. And we've seen lately that, you know, in recent times that it's difficult for some people. You know, because they're used to going out.
Yeah, it's just odd just from the standpoint of, you know, I always instill in my sons that when you meet somebody, you look them square in the eye and give them a firm handshake. There's no handshaking now. You know, I mean, it's crazy. Everything I kind of like taught them is being thrown right out the window. So it's really difficult and it's uncomfortable. And, you know, one of the few things that I can enjoy still is I play golf, and it's one of the best social distancing sports or games or whatever you want to call it that you can participate in. So every Saturday morning, man, I'm like first tee time.
I used to golf a little bit, but I do more bowling. I'm more of a bowler.
Okay. So can you do that now?
Bowling, a lot of bowling alleys are not open yet. So yes. We can't bowl outside, unfortunately.
So it must really be hurting.
Yeah, it's killing me right now. Have you had a chance to get in? And obviously you haven't been able to do any racing or, you know, any karting. I know you've been doing some karting, you know, before this happened. You haven't had a chance to get on the track at all since this has been going on, huh?
No, I haven't. It's not even worth the risk from my perspective. I just am enjoying the fact that at least I can watch some of the other guys out there racing. They're still running the NASCAR races, as you saw, and Formula One kicked off this past weekend. It was great to see that. Wasn't the result I wanted for Lewis, but all that's going to do is make him hungrier.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be an interesting season, with only 8 races, as we know so far. We're not sure if there are going to be any added ones, if the United States Grand Prix is going to happen. It's not looking likely. I mean, given what's happened in Texas, there's been a rise in Texas, and we were hopeful that maybe that might get added to the calendar, but it's a very unpredictable season right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything's up in the air. Even with regards to the NASCAR races, where they are, I guess, have an environment where they've been really the most safe. Jimmie Johnson just got afflicted by COVID-19 and, he tested positive, even though he was asymptomatic. And, you just don't know what's going to happen there. And then, we're trying, as open up the NBA season, and, Major League Baseball is up in flux. I mean, all these athletes are coming down with it. Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen, and nobody obviously knows what's going to happen, but, I just wish the leadership at the top of our country would take a slightly more proactive stance on, doing the right thing, making sure that American citizens are safe, leading by example by wearing a mask, and stop being so darn cavalier about situation. But, I'm not going to try to bring the politics into it, but, I just still really believe that if you set an example for the country to follow, that's a good thing. And the example that's being set, I'm so disagreement with that it's not even funny. It's whatever.
I think sometimes people miss that it's not necessarily about them when it comes to this situation. It's about other people. It's about spreading. It's about looking out. For people like your mother. Your in-laws and my mother and other elderlies or immunocompromised individuals. That can this could really seriously afflict. I have relatives that are in, in nursing and the medical field, and they see this firsthand, in the hospital, in the ICU, and it's serious. And I think if anybody had a chance to see this, firsthand from what they see, I think it would really wake people up to see, the amount of people that this is hurting, this is afflicting, the amount of people who die, on an hourly basis at times. When it comes to this and how rampant it is.
Yeah, it would make it real instead of just a news story. When it's a news story, it's just kind of isolated from you. It doesn't really hit home. But like you said, if they were front and center in terms of what's going on the front lines, I think it would change a lot of attitudes.
Definitely. Now, I wanted, since you touched on Formula One, Formula One's rolled out some initiatives to increase diversity, inclusion. Chase Carey is going to donate from his own personal funds $1 million to help with apprenticeships and internships inside Formula One. Also establishing a task force to help tackle the situation. If you had a chance to talk to that task force, give the feedback, what would be some of your suggestions on how to handle that with Formula One?
Well, no, I haven't talked to anybody there. They haven't reached out to me, but I was impressed with the We Stand as One hashtag that was being, promoted around the circuit this past weekend. I liked the Black Lives Matter with the fist that Lewis Hamilton had on his helmet. I thought that was a really strong statement as well. But no, I just think the whole Formula One community understands that, we should all be treated equally. We were all created equally, but we're not all treated equally. And I think a lot of the disparity that has definitely been prevalent here in the States is being seen worldwide. And, I just don't know what it's like over in Europe per se. It's been a while since I've been overseas, but I think that what they see here with the United States being typically has been a leader internationally. I think we've made some missteps as a result of, what's been happening with our presidency has made us, not as favorable or enviable a position as we once were. But having said all that, there are definitely some things that can be done. I think the key thing is that what's happened here in the States is as a result of the fact that we as people of color are tired of the racial inequity and systemic racism and police brutality and all the things that have been taking place. And the situation is different now than some of the outcries we've had in the past, because more people than just us are rebelling against the system of systemic racism. We're not just by ourselves in this movement. you know, we have support across the, you know, across the situation, the landscape. And so I think that ears are open, people are paying attention, people are being receptive, and it really remains to be seen what real steps are going to be taken. But what happens here is that there's been a culture of white privilege, where most of them have been in positions of power and authority for so long that they don't know what it's like being not them, right? And so when we have this Black Lives Matter movement, we're not asking for, you know, what they think is Black power or Black supremacy. No, we're just asking for Black equality. Equality amongst everybody, right? That's all. Treat us all the same. And it seems to me that a lot of the things I've seen from social media and such is that they feel they're giving up something by being allowing this the landscape to be equal. But it's going to take a long time for the landscape to be equal because the, you know, the situation has been unbalanced for so long. We don't control what's going on in corporate America. Most of all the decisions that take place in corporate America and in the boardrooms are by white males. You know, some white females have broken through, and there have been some people of color that have broken through, but very few. And so until we are at a, you know, table that's got everybody on the same playing field, essentially, it's going to be difficult. And so, you know, what are we going to do to change things? Well, let's make it so that it's not a situation where we're asking for them to do something specifically to give us a handout or anything like that. No, we're just asking, don't disqualify us based on our color. You know, just treat us equally. So it's really got to be, the first thing has got to be a mind shift, a paradigm shift in terms of the way people think. And it just hasn't been like that. And I don't know how long it's going to take before that really takes place, because unfortunately, people see color, people see differences. And sometimes, or I should say more so than not, act accordingly. You know, it's always like somebody has to be on top of somebody else to get somewhere. And, you know, and it's unfortunate that that's been the case, but that's got to change. And I think that now that we're in the era that we're in, the reception is much greater than it has been in the past. So really what's going on right now is, I think, awareness and, you know, maybe some empathy, but we really need to have some things take place that are tangible and measurable to try to gain, get to a goal. Exactly what those things are in Formula One, I mean, you know, really, how many Black drivers have there been in Formula One? You know, I mean, you know, I know that Willie T tested an F1 car way back when, never got to the track to compete. And outside of Lewis Hamilton, I'm remiss to think of anybody else. Has there been anybody else?
No, there hasn't. It actually hasn't. Lewis Hamilton is the only and the first Black British driver to break into the sport and to be as successful as he is. You know, what is that for you as a Black driver, a Black race car driver? What does that mean to see Lewis Hamilton achieve those accolades, achieve those goals that he has in that sport, even though he's a British driver and you're an African-American race car driver?
Yeah, I'm still extremely proud of him because he is a driver of color. You know, he is just not the regular, you know, the cookie cutter, typical standard race car driver. He has somewhat of a diverse background, being his, you know, father's Black, his mother's white. So, you know, by all intents and purposes, he's Black. So no, I don't care if he's British, I don't care if he's Italian, I don't care, you know, what his nationality is or what country he comes from. The fact that he is of Black descent is, or African-American or African descent is, you know, really heartwarming for me to see that. And for him to do as well as he's done, you know, he was able to take advantage of a very, very rare opportunity. I'm sure everybody knows the story about how his father got him into a go-kart at a young age, but if it wasn't for Ron Dennis, he wouldn't be where he is. You know, Ron Dennis saw his talent and brought him under the McLaren fold. And, you know, the rest they say is history because they groomed him through the ranks. And so he proved that, you know, it was more than just his color of his skin. He is talented on any, you know, stretch of the imagination or benchmark that you want to put him through. So, I mean, it's great that he's doing what he's doing. He represents himself extremely well. He definitely is a leader for change, is a change agent. And he, I think, is doing all he can within his platform to evoke change. And I think that's wonderful. I think that, you know, we should all see each other as human beings, not, you know, you're better than I am or you're worse than I am or whatever the case is because of your color. It should be because of, you know, like Martin Luther King said, it's the content of your character. It's not the color of your skin.
I think that couldn't be put any better. You know, I want to ask, like, what have been some of your challenges when you were coming into racing and then moving forward with that? What do you think are going to be the challenges with Formula One reaching out to communities of color and say, especially here in the States, in that path, you know, for inspiring race car drivers of color wanting to get into that level, that top level of motorsport?
So I kind of got your question kind of got long for me. What was the first part of it?
The first part is going to, we'll cover what you had to deal with in your journey into becoming a race car driver and getting into NASCAR and in sports car racing. What were those challenges and that you faced when you were coming into it?
Yeah, well, they were plentiful. You know, I was an anomaly throughout my whole racing career. You know, I did not come from a racing family, wasn't born with wealth. You know, the only reason I made it as a race car driver is because my father took me to a race when I was just shy of 8 years old. And it was because he knew of my love of cars and speed. So, you know, a friend of his said, you know, I heard your son likes cars and stuff. Why don't you take him to a race? And so my father's like, yeah, maybe I'll do that. And so he took me to a race when I was very young and it blew me away. It set the hook. And I was like, wow, I would love to be able to do something like this. Nothing moved me like these cars going by me at 160, 170 miles an hour. I mean, it was intoxicating. But when I looked around the racetrack, even though I didn't make a big deal of it, I noticed nobody looked like my father and I. Nobody else there at the racetrack looked like us. But the good thing is that it was a sports car race in Northern California. And California is a progressive state. Had he taken me to a race at Darlington, South Carolina or Talladega, Alabama or something like that, I think I probably had a completely different idea about wanting to go racing because it would have probably been so uncomfortable, we wouldn't have stayed long enough to enjoy the race. But we enjoyed the race through and through, and I was just enamored by what it is I experienced. And I knew then that I wanted to be a race car driver. But again, I didn't get that go-kart that Lewis Hamilton got in his single-digit years. That just wasn't in the offing for me. My folks were like, no, we don't do this racing stuff. We don't know anything about this racing stuff. It's not something that's easily accessible. Racing isn't something like a stick and ball sport where you can just go outside and play with your friends, right? You got to have a go-kart or some kind of motorized vehicle.
Right.
You got to have a circuit to run it on, right? You can't just pick up a ball and throw it to your friend or, you know, go play basketball or, you know, whatever the case is. It's a concerted effort to get to a racetrack. And where I grew up, that just wasn't, you know, in the cards. That just wasn't happening. So I did the traditional stick and ball sports growing up, but then I got my driver's license and it was game on. It was the Fast and the Furious before it was a movie. I was doing all sorts of illegal things that I don't condone, right? But my, you know, some people saw what I was able to do and I had a reputation as a street racer and people said, look, before you kill yourself or somebody else doing what you're doing, take it to a racetrack. And I was like, okay, well, that'd be great to take it to a racetrack. How do you do that, right? Because I didn't know how to go racing. Well, needless to say, the common denominator amongst all this is you got to have money. So what I did is I immersed myself in technology and I went to Cal Berkeley, which was at the time the second highest school in engineering in the country to MIT. I got a degree in electrical engineering and computer science. And I was getting that degree right there effectively at the beginning of the high-tech boom. So I knew that if I got that piece of paper, I could write my ticket. And effectively, that's what I did. With that first paycheck that I got from Hewlett-Packard Computer Company, where I started working in the Silicon Valley, I went and started going racing at SCCA, which is Sports Car Club of America. And so my first year, I was Rookie of the Year for Northern California. And then the next year, I was Northern California Road Racing Champion for my class. And I thought immediately, with having accomplished that, I was going pro racing, right? No. But even before that, let me tell you, when I showed up at SCCA driver school, I was the only one of color. When I was out there racing, I was pretty much the only one of color. I even had some folks coming up going like, you know, why are you out here? You know, you guys don't race. And I was like, excuse me, I'm here to race, you know? I mean, so there's been a little bit of pushback and a little bit of, you know, unwelcomeness, but I look beyond that because I knew that I enjoyed racing. And so anyway, after I started, you know, doing so well in amateur racing, I thought the doors of corporate America be swinging wide open, right? It's like, here I am doing well. It's time to go pro.
Right.
You know, the phone calls were not, you know, not returned. And a lot of it, I think, had to do with the fact that in the sponsorship proposals, you know, I could put a nice picture of myself in there, and they're probably looking at like, nah, I'm not going to probably do something that we're not comfortable doing yet as a company, you know? So what I did is then I gathered enough family and friends and enough of my savings from working in the company to put myself through my first pro race, which is an IMSA GTO race that I did at Monterey. No, I did it at Sears Point in Sonoma in 1989. I did really well there. And then I thought, you know, again, corporate America was going to come running. They didn't. I did some SCCA Trans Am races on the pro level as well. And no, once again, corporate America was not responsive. And so I had a 15-year career at Hewlett-Packard before, with my wife's blessing, who I got married to in between this time. She said, look, you're not getting any younger and you're not getting any easier to live with. Devote yourself to trying to make your dream a reality, or say that you gave it your best and it wasn't meant to happen. So we gave ourselves a 3-year window by which I would try to devote all of my time and attention to becoming a full-time professional race car driver. I went on leave of absence from HP for 6 months. And then after 6 months, I put the corporate job in the rearview mirror. I said goodbye to HP. And people thought I was absolutely crazy. They're like, wait a minute, you're successful. And I'm like, well, no, I'm not successful. They go, no, you are successful. You got a 6-figure income. You're managing a couple dozen engineers. And I'm like, I don't define that as success. I define success as happiness. And I was completely unhappy and unfulfilled with what it is I was doing. I was good at it, but it wasn't what I felt was my calling. I felt I should be racing a car. You know, I felt that I was given gifts, God-given gifts to go out there and do it. And so that's why I left HP, to try to just do it whole, you know, whole hog, just with both feet, not dip a toe in the water, not try to do the 8 to 5 Monday through Friday and then try to be, you know, a weekend warrior. I couldn't do it. I wasn't effective. I couldn't do what was necessary without devoting my full time and attention to this pursuit. So lo and behold, after some pro races here and there, I got my big break because I was given the chance to test a stock car. And it was a strange situation as to why this happened. I was introduced to a guy named Ed Renzi, who is a mutual friend of mine, of a friend of mine. And he said to me, he said, Bill, have you ever raced a heavy car? He goes, you know, I've seen you race these sports cars and stuff like that, but have you ever raced a heavy car? I'm like, well, what's a heavy car? He said, a stock car. And I'm like, no, I've never raced a stock car. I've never even been on an oval or been on dirt, which is like the common denominator amongst all the NASCAR drivers. They say, we all grew up on dirt. Well, I didn't, I've never seen dirt, okay? Except go and play in. So anyway, that's a misnomer. But he gave me a test in an ARCA car, which is, you know, competing series to NASCAR. And I thought it was going to be an exclusive test all by myself. And we wind up going to Anderson, Indiana, to a quarter mile high bank short track with a figure eight infield. You know, where they do the demolition derby stuff. And it was a full-on ARCA race weekend. I mean, the heavy hitters in ARCA were there. I mean, Frank Kimmel, Ken Schrader. And I was like, looking at all these haulers around and all that stuff and all these cars, I'm like, what is going on here, right? They back out a primer gray backup car to the primary car that Ed had entered into the race. And he said, okay, Bill, show me what you got. And I'm like, what do you mean show you what I got? He said, okay, here's your track, here's your car. Let me see if you got any skills. And I was like, okay. Threw my helmet on and all that kind of stuff. And had the times that I put in practice been in qualifying, I would have been top 10 starting position. But he wasn't ready to enter me in the race. He just wanted to see if I could conduct myself on a race weekend during an ARCA practice. And sure enough, I could. And he said, listen, no promises, but I'm going to try to get you into NASCAR. And lo and behold, I became the first Black driver to make an Xfinity or Busch Grand National start back then in 1999 when I made my debut at Watkins Glen on the road course there. Then I did subsequently a couple of one-off truck races, but then Dodge created a diversity program in 2001. And I got the nod in 2002. Willie T got the first opportunity and ran the number 8 Dodge Ram in 2001. And then they did the program and reevaluated it, reassessed it. And I was given the opportunity to run the truck from 2002 to 2003, at which point I became a full-time professional race car driver at 40 years of age. And then I made my, Cup debut, but at the time it was Nextel Cup debut in 2006 at Atlanta Motor Speedway at 45 years of age.
And that's an amazing achievement. Did you and Willie ever cross paths?
We absolutely did. When I was working in the Silicon Valley, that's kind of like Cupertino, California, which is a rock's throw away from San Jose, which is Willie's hometown. And so Willie and I were fast friends. We were really good friends back when I was working in the tech sector, because I would like jump, you know, away from the office at lunch, go hang out with Willie, try to pick his brain, hang out with him, you know, see what he was doing to become or just to be a professional race car driver, learn all the things that I should do and all the things I shouldn't do, because Willie T and I are cut from very different cloths. he grew up, you know, pretty much blue collar on a ranch and all that stuff, shooting guns. And, you know, you see him now, he's always wearing a cowboy hat if he's not wearing his uppity cap. And I was as white collar as they came, you know, 4-year degree from Cal Berkeley and all that kind of stuff. And, but the fact is, he was where I wanted to be. He was a professional race car driver and I was trying to become one. So I was kind of like learning from, or at the feet of the master, because he was where I wanted to be. I watched him in Trans Am and IMSA, and I watched him in, you know, the Indy 500, and you know, he was the big dude. He was the big man on campus, right? So for him and I to become friends, which by the way happened as a fluke. Let me tell you how we met. Remember I told you I went to SCCA driving school. That was at Sears Point.
Right.
And for whatever reason, Willie T was there at Sears Point. And I don't know to this day why he was there, but he was there. And when I was in between sessions, on-track sessions during driving school, he came up to me. He walked up to me, and I was like, looking at him, I was like, I know who that is and everything. And he walked up to me, and he goes, I've been watching you. In as deep as Willie T voice, I've been watching you. You have what it takes to make it in this sport. And I was blown away that he just, you know, unsolicited came out and said that, because he had been watching me. I guess I was doing really well in driver school, you know. And at that point, you know, he gave me his information and I reached out to him and, you know, we, at that point, started a great friendship. I've known Willie T for a long time. We don't hang out really at all anymore. He's gone on to Texas and, you know, I guess there's a lot of water underneath the bridge, but for whatever reason, we don't really communicate much, but he's still, you know, pushing the fight and just trying to make sure that this sport becomes more inclusive. He's very, very hard on NASCAR. He's thinking it's all lip service. Up to this point, there has been a lot of lip service. I hope that changed. I reached out to Steve Phelps, the president of NASCAR, who I've known for, you know, since mid-2000s, and told him that I was impressed with the positioning that they've taken and that I'm there to help them. I really want NASCAR to be successful in opening their doors and making it welcome to everybody. You know, the blue collar redneck is, you know, that market's tapped out for them and they know that. All you got to do is look at the stands and they're being taken out. There was one point where I was racing there in the mid 2000s. That was the height of NASCAR. I mean, on a race weekend, there'd be 150, 160,000 people. You know, before the pandemic, they were lucky if they got 50,000 people. You know, most of the numbers I heard for crowd was like 30 to 40,000 people. So it was really on the decline. Because again, their traditional fan base was tapped out. All of them got aged out, and the millennials that came behind them just weren't interested in NASCAR. It just, you know, didn't resonate with them. So, you know, there are a lot of closet NASCAR fans of color. And I know that because when I was out there on the Truck Series, you know, platform for a number of years, I saw the hue of the stands change. And then when I went away, it reverted right back to its typical self, because we didn't feel comfortable being out there in an environment, for the most part, where we couldn't rally behind and support one of our own. That's really what it comes down to. That's why golf became so popular, because of, you know, what Tiger Woods has done, excuse me. And, you know, tennis has become so popular because of what Arthur Ashe has done before Venus and Serena. And, you know, we like winners. That's all there is to it. And if we see people that are out there that look like us doing something, we support them. We support each other. And so now that Bubba's come on the scene, you know, the few has started to change again, you know, as much as it can in a pandemic. It can't change that much, but it still has begun to shift. And as long as we can get more of us out there, it's going to continue to shift. And that's really what NASCAR's challenge is, you know? And so I don't know what's behind the curtain in terms of their plans, but they know that I'm there hopefully to help guide them through this change, you know, in period of what's going on. I know for a fact that they have just made an appointment for vice president of diversity and inclusion by appointing a guy by the name of Brandon Thompson, who's got 17 years there. He's a brother who's got 17 years there with the company. And so I hope he's able to affect change. And, you know, I guess it just becomes a matter of wait and see. Let's just kind of see what happens.
Yeah. What do you think that, what do you think sports like NASCAR, Formula One, you know, especially, we know Formula One is trying to gain more visibility here in the United States. What's going to be some of those key things that they need to do going forward to broaden, you know, their audience and bring in new fans?
Well, the difficult thing with Formula One is that it's a one-time hit, right? They have COTA, and I was thinking they were going to have a second venue, but when Formula One only comes to the United States once a year, it's very difficult without a lot of, you know, promotion to get people to get out there, to for them to know about it. You know, the reason why NASCAR is so popular is because they race virtually every weekend, and people know that there is going to be a NASCAR race. People have absolutely, unless you're an insider and you follow the sport like I do or like you do, people don't know when Formula One is coming. By the time they know Formula One is coming, it's pretty much gone, right? And most of the drivers, or all the drivers, are non-American. We have to have an American in F1 who is going to be, you know, prominent, promoted, front and center. All these guys that are coming from Italy and England and, you know, Germany and all that kind of stuff, we're not identifying with. They don't matter to us. We are all about, you know, like American pride, not Southern, you know, rebel pride, as far as I'm concerned. I sure hope that stigma starts to continue to go by the wayside, but American pride. We need an American driver, and we need at least one more venue. As a matter of fact, I thought they were trying to get one in Miami, and it seemed like that all became unraveled. But
there was talk of Miami for a bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there was Indianapolis was there on, you know, for a minute. And, you know, traditionally they had the Vegas Formula One race, but there's only always been one race. We need to have more than one race so we can gain some momentum in terms of Formula One. And most importantly, we need to have an American driver. I mean, I think the last driver who was really trying to do it was Michael Andretti, I think. I mean, I think yes. Alex Rossi was trying to do something, but I don't think that ever materialized. But, you know, until we have an American driver that we can rally behind, just like, you know, blacks coming out to the racetrack if they see a black driver out there, you know, behind the wheel. We need to see an American driver behind the wheel. Then right. It becomes real to Americans.
Well, so far we've got an American team with Haas, you know, but you're like you said, we don't have the rest of the puzzle put together with an American driver in F1. And we've sort of adopted Lewis because a lot of people I've talked to and met, you know Formula One through Lewis, you know, and his platform and social media, you know, because he's got so many followers on social media, you know, people discover him and they say, oh, I learned about Formula One from meeting him. So he's sort of, you know, been adopted essentially a little bit from America. But yes, of course, we need to have an American driver in Formula One. And hopefully at some point we will get someone in there. But that, like I was talking to you earlier, which was the second part of the question, was the path. You know, there's a path if you go to Europe and you race in, you know, F2, F3, and you work your way into F1. But for a lot of drivers here in the States, they're really, you know, there's a difficult path trying to get from here into F1. So I was going to ask you, what do you think could change or what could happen in terms of trying to build a path? You know, is there something that you think Formula One could do to help sort of build a path for American drivers that want to get into the sport?
Well, I think to be serious about Formula One, you have to make the commitment to go overseas, first and foremost. You have to go over to England, and you have to start out in, you know, the Formula 1600 and stuff like that, the feeder series that get you up to Formula 3, Formula 2, and, you know, eventually Formula 1. You can't just, you know, do it over here and then hope you're going to be successful over there. They race very differently over in Europe than we do here. I've heard it. I don't know for a fact from personal experience, but I heard it from enough drivers that have tried to do it and that have done it. that you can't run like you race over here in the States, then all of a sudden try to show up over there in Europe and think you're going to be successful. You have to start at a very young age, and you have to go up through the European ranks so that you know how cutthroat their driving and their racing is. It's not like ours is. I think ours is pretty, you know, watered down compared to what's going on over there. I mean, because there are so many people trying to get to F1 worldwide, right? We have our pool over here in terms of racing in America, but think about our small pool over here in America versus racing in a venue where all the participants are coming from all around the world, right? So it's a much bigger, much more cutthroat, much more difficult ladder to climb. And if you're going to be serious about trying to be an F1 driver, you need to start at the grassroots over there in Europe and go through there. Now, that's a very difficult proposition, granted, because it means living over in Europe, you know, just embedding yourself in the European culture, probably in England, because, you know, they speak English there. It'd be a whole lot harder to try to do it in Italy and try to learn the language and all that kind of stuff. As an American, you know, they would frown on us anyway. But in England, I think you have a reasonable chance. You know, I mean, that's where Willie T went to try to get his start. You know, Danica Patrick spent some time over there trying to do things. Alex Rossi, I think, was over there in Europe trying to do some stuff.
Yes.
But that's one of the things that was unsuccessful for Michael Andretti when he went to try to do it, because he was doing all this stuff over here. And then he tried to show up over there in Europe. They didn't really know who he was. Didn't have really much respect for him for the most part, even though he's Mario's son. You would think that there would be a lot of doors opening, but, you know, it didn't really seem that way. And so he just wasn't prepared. So to be prepared to race in Formula One, you have to start out really young. You have to, you know, infiltrate yourself into that culture, know how to race over there, know how the politics is played over there, because that is just as important, the politics of racing, as the sport of racing is. Don't let anybody tell you there's no politics in racing. So you got to know all that stuff. Now, how do you do that to build a feeder system so that that happens? Well, it would have to be started out by somebody over here in the States that wants to see a, you know, American become a Formula One champion. I don't know who's ready to do that. I mean, you know, when you think about the open wheel series that are over here in terms of IndyCar, they're interested in, you know, people racing over here in the States in IndyCar. And so they're stepping, you know, their ladder is like Formula Mazda, you know, Formula Atlantic, you know, whatever the formulas are, Indy Lights, you know, that sort of thing. That get you to being able to race at the top level of racing here in the States. So it's going to be a completely different paradigm shift and program put in place to get somebody over here to be successful over there. And it's not going to be simple, because it's going to take cubic dollars. It's going to take a lot of money to support somebody coming up at a young age and going through the ranks over in Europe. That means all the schooling and education, all the, you know, the cost of living and all that kind of stuff, the cost to prepare the car and the fuel of the car, all those things. It's a huge undertaking. So I don't know what the answer to that's going to be, but I can tell you it's going to take a lot of time and effort and resources.
Do you think it would help if a Penske or a Andretti would get into Formula One, if Ford decided to want to get into Formula One, become an engine supplier, maybe put a program together? Do you think getting those guys in somehow or getting them interested in getting into Formula One would help?
Well, absolutely. There's no question that would help, but I just question whether or not there would be any interest from any of those groups that you mentioned in doing that. Because, you know, here we like our American racing. That, you know, that's all there is to it. We, you know, NASCAR, IndyCar, sports cars with IMSA, you know, those are our platforms. You know, Formula One is interesting, but it is just almost like a foreign country to us. You know, I mean, that's why it's really going to be hard to get an American to get into Formula One and to be successful in Formula One, is because it doesn't resonate here. I hope somebody starts thinking out of the box and can open, you know, those channels so that it changes, just like with regard to what's going on with the movement with Black Lives Matter and such. But it's going to, you know, it's going to take somebody with a big commitment to make that happen. And I don't know who that is. I don't feel that Penske is going to be interested in doing that, or Ganassi, or, you know, Ford, or, you know, GM. I mean, especially with regard to the way American business is going right now, everybody's hurting financially. So
yeah.
I just don't see anybody stepping up and meeting that challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were talking earlier about the background you come from a very white collar background. Your dad worked for IBM, you know, you work for HP, you know, you have a degree in engineering and science. I mean, you obviously, you know, not typical race car driver background. So I have to ask you though, are you Star Trek or Star Wars?
Oh, Trek.
Trek.
I just like the old school Trek. I had a feeling, even though it's like sappy and campy. Yeah, it's sappy and campy when you watch it, but I still, you know, Star Trek was my thing when way back in the day. You know, there've been so many Star Wars movies that I you know, and they came out so spread out, I lost interest. You know, I just, you know, I look at a Star Wars thing and I'm like, what is that? You know, so, but Star Trek, just like, you know, again, NASCAR, it was like on all the time. You knew it was coming on. You could follow it. It wasn't like, you know, here's the Star Wars movie, episode one, 20 years ago, and the next one you got to wait 5 years for. You know, I mean, it's like, so consistency goes a long way.
I'm a next generation guy, but I went back and started watching a lot more of the, you know, older series with, you know, with William Shatner. So I started watching a lot of it, and I have a lot of respect for it. I mean, it was groundbreaking at its time, you know, for the things that they did, you know, writing and the narratives that were going on. That were just, I think they really were ahead of their time, you know, and going into Next Generation, they just expanded on what was built in the original series.
Mm-hmm. No, I feel the same way. I just think that, like you said, Star Trek was ahead of its time. It was futuristic. It got you thinking, wow, this is, you know, it made you think. It just really opened your mind up and everything. But now, I mean, there's just so many platforms for entertainment and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, now these mediums don't really have the impact that like a Star Trek did then, because there are so few different things that you could watch and that you could really follow and get into. Now, I mean, there are so many platforms for entertainment. It's like, I don't know how you capture anybody's interest nowadays.
It's a field of streaming services now. You know, I mean, you have your pick of the litter of what you want to watch, you know, and there's so much to watch. You're just overloaded at times.
You're absolutely right. It's like trying to get my family together to watch a single program is almost impossible, because we all have our different interests and tastes. We can't agree on what we want to watch. So all of a sudden, what starts out to be a family get together and watching TV, you know, 20 minutes into it, well, I'm out. Yep, yeah, I'm out too.
It is. It really is. I just recently watched Hamilton this weekend, you know.
Okay, cool.
And it was amazing. You know, I mean, just a brilliant, well put together play that was just absolutely wonderful to watch. I hate that I didn't get a chance to watch it live in the theater. You know, and the video version is great, and I recommend anybody to watch it, because it was absolutely wonderful to watch.
Well, I was blessed and fortunate enough to actually see it on Broadway, so I know exactly what you're talking about. I haven't seen it, you know, on Disney Plus yet, but what a production. I mean, it's phenomenal. Yeah. I recommend that for anybody. I haven't talked or heard from anybody who didn't like it.
Yeah, it really was. And I that's the one thing I'm going to miss right now during this pandemic, is missing going to plays, because I enjoy going to plays. You know, I've been to Wicked, I've been to Laserman's and Rob, and, you know, I've seen quite a few plays, and I'm just something, you know, the theater experience is something that's just separated from anything else that you can go see, you know, when seeing the arts.
Well, it's amazing, you know, in light of the situation that we're in with, you know, sheltering in place and all that kind of stuff. So many things that you took for granted before, you know, you just miss them now, you know, things that you're like, you just never even thought about. Now you think about it. It's like, well, is it safe to go out and walk? Is, you know, do I need to bring a mask? And I mean, just all these things that you're like, well, yeah. Are you kidding me? I mean, it's just, it's such a shame. It's so sad. And like I said, kind of before, I really think it's a tragedy for my kids, you know, for my sons, because it's like, you know, they're just cooped up. They can't hang out with their friends. You know, I mean, everything is virtual with their phone, and it's just not like it should be. You know, they should be out and, you know, enjoying playing around outside and hanging out. And you can't hardly do that without concern and, you know, fear.
Exactly. Have you ever thought of, have your sons ever been interested in racing, or have you thought about wanting them to get into racing?
I'll tell you what, I did what I believe every parent should do. Expose your kids to as many different things as possible. And so, needless to say, I put my kids in go-karts for a minute, just, you know, not competitively per se, but, you know, just goofing around. And there was no fire. There was no passion. Hmm. And I was completely good with that. You know, my wallet was over the moon. You know what? I know how much it costs. And if one of them or both of them wanted to get involved, I just don't know how I'd be able to afford it. You know, even with the, you know, resources I have in terms of people I know and the things that I know and ins and outs. I mean, at the end of the day, you got to strike a check, you know? And so it's like, my sons were like, nah, Dad, I'm good. I'm like, okay, I'm good too.
Oh, wow. But you've been doing some karting, you know, and because you never really went through a lot of formal training into racing, you know, and you're just now karting. What's the karting experience been like for you?
Well, you know, I was karting for a very, very short time. You know, I went through my professional road racing career, and that ended in 2012. But that same year, I was out there just at a kart track in Florida, renting a kart, a shifter kart, just because I just wanted to scratch the itch, right? And the guy who owned the kart track actually owned a kart team. And he was watching me going around, and he said, you want to enter a kart race? And I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? And so, you know, started karting with him. And the next thing you know, he's grooming me for, and this is 50 years of age, okay? He's grooming me for international Rotax karting competition. So believe it or not, I was part of, you know, after I went through the ranks of, you know, challenge races and qualifying races and all that kind of stuff to get me to the point where I was on Team USA. We got there to Portimão, Portugal, and this was in 2012, and I'm representing Team USA in DD2 Masters, which is guys 36 and up, I guess. So I'm really old for these. So these guys are still young to me, but I'm still out there duking it out in a kart. And it's funny, I am writing a memoir and actually kind of finishing it up. I'm getting close, called Winning in Reverse. And it's Winning in Reverse is a motivational memoir, first of all, because it's one of really living your dreams and, you know, taking risks and, you know, networking. I name about 8 certain attributes that allowed me to be successful in my living my dream. And it's called Winning in Reverse because I became a professional race car driver, which was my dream, completely opposite of the way it's supposed to happen. You're supposed to be at a very young age in some sort of competitive race car, you know, whether it be a quarter midget, kart, you know, whatever. And then going through the ranks as you get into your teenage years.
Right.
My teenage years went right on by me, still no racing, right? 22 years of age, I start out in SECA in a full-size race car. I become a professional race car driver at 40. You know, and then my last competitive racing is at 50 years of age, and I finally get to race a kart. So that's why it's Winning in Reverse. And so it'll be out February 2nd of next year, and I'm hoping that it does really well. We expect it, anticipate it will. I'm going to have some blurbs from some very prominent people that I think will help move it along. But yeah, you know, I've been very fortunate. It wasn't easy. It was been fighting and scratching and clawing the whole way. Lots of doubters and naysayers. You know, I can only imagine what Bubba Wallace is dealing with regard to, you know, the position on the Confederate flag that NASCAR supported him on.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a very tough road to hoe. I don't care who you are, you know, black, white, you know, male, female, it's very tough. But being, you know, a black American male is another level of difficulty. Yeah. You know, so the fact is that I made it, though, and yeah. I'm proud of that. And, you know, I just hope that things continue to change in terms of more guys like, you know, Bubba out there, you know, somebody that looks like Bubba or I out there in an IndyCar, somebody, other guys like Lewis Hamilton out there looking, you know, like he does in Formula One. You know, we have a couple guys in drag racing, fortunately. We got, you know, Antoine Brown and J.R. Todd at the NHRA level, and yeah. It's much more gender diverse. We got women driving in NHRA. I don't know why NHRA is so successful.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to look at their model. I think it may have to do with the fact that it's so easy to go drag racing by comparison to this other stuff, you know, because
seems like they have a real grassroots, real grassroots.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, as soon as you get a car, you can, you know, drag race it, you know. You can't go out there and go oval track racing as soon as you get a car. You can't go out there, you know, and road race as soon as you get a car.
Right.
You know, anybody can go stoplight to stoplight, right? So it's a little bit more easily exposed to. But I just think that we're in an era now where we're at change. And I think that the momentum will continue to, you know, carry forward because we have prominent people using their platform to continue to push things forward, whether it be Bubba Wallace, whether it be Lewis Hamilton, whether it be me on the small platform I have, you know,
yeah.
Whether it be Willie T, what he's doing. You know, there's been some folks that have actually just said, okay, let's continue to try to make this a reality. Let's try to make this sport and this country more inclusive, more diverse. Let's stop dealing with racism, systemic racism, and, you know, police brutality, and treat each other like we were created as equals.
Bill, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking with us and spending time with us here. I mean, this has been absolutely an incredible moment talking with you and getting your insight on everything, you know, and I really look forward to talking to you again.
That sounds good, Seth. I enjoyed our time as well.
We want to thank Bill Lester for joining us here on The Rundown. And as always, my friends, I'll see you when the lights go out.